This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In years past, the phrase states' rights was enough to send liberals to the barricades. In the 19th century, states' rights was the banner of secession and slavery. In the 20th century, it was code for racial segregation. Any liberal of a certain age who hears those words will immediately summon the image of Governor George Wallace standing in the doorway at the University of Alabama in a last-ditch effort to bar black students. Federal marshals moved Wallace aside. Federal court orders, federal legislation, and sometimes federal troops were the instruments of desegregation and later women's rights. Liberals traditionally believe in federal authority, but after the last election, some liberals are beginning to reconsider states' rights. Later in the program, the longest winning streak in TV game show history is reported to be in jeopardy. But first, states' rights. Issues like medical marijuana, physician-assisted suicide, gay marriage, education, health care, taxes, crime and punishment, the environment, and should the Supreme Court reverse Roe v. Wade, abortion can all be portrayed as states' rights issues. Democrats, is it time to take up the banner of states' rights? Republicans, since you control Congress and the White House, do you now view federal authority more favorably? We're going to hear from three proponents who've thought through some of the pluses and minuses, and of course we want to hear from you. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now by phone from outside Philadelphia is Marcy Hamilton, a professor of constitutional law and currently a visiting scholar at Princeton's Theological Seminary. Good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thanks very much.
Yesterday, for example, the Supreme Court heard arguments about medical marijuana. We heard a lot about drug policy and the Interstate Commerce Clause. How does that issue play as a states' rights issue?
Well, the issue in that case is whether or not the California state law that permits people to use marijuana for medical problems, if it's prescribed by a doctor, question is, does that state law stand even though the federal government has a general ban against all use of marijuana? So it's a classic fight between the state and the federal governments over social policy.
Interestingly, Alabama filed a friend of the court brief on behalf of the two California women who argued that they have a medical right to use marijuana. Again, I guess those are true believers in states' rights.
Well, there are the true believers in states' rights who continue to support the idea that the states ought to have latitude to be 50 state laboratories in social policy. And then there are the former states' rights supporters who now have federal power and see that states' rights can be an impediment to their federal power. So there, we've got both kinds out there.
And I guess there's an element of opportunism on both sides.
Well, it's inevitable, and the framers of the Constitution fundamentally understood this, that anyone who holds power will be sorely tempted to abuse it. And once someone sits in a position of power, it's going to be very difficult to persuade them that that power ought to be limited in some meaningful way. So if you gain federal power, the White House and the Congress, it's going to be very difficult to persuade the Republicans at this point that the states ought to have wide latitude to do what they need to do, even if it's not consistent with the federal government's policies.
This is about, in some respects, the 10th Amendment to the Constitution.
It's about the 10th Amendment, but it's also about the principle that runs through the entire Constitution that we have two sovereigns, both the federal sovereign and the state sovereigns.
The idea, though, of state sovereignty has eroded considerably over the past couple of hundred years.
Well, especially in the 20th century, by the 1930s, the United States had essentially given up on limiting Congress in any way, shape, or form. So by the time we got to 1995, which was the first federalism decision of recent note, nobody believed anymore that there could be a limit on Congress. Congress looked like it had plenary power over every issue in the United States. Since 1995, with the Supreme Court putting some moderate limitations on Congress, there's been a slow rebuilding of the wall around Congress, saying Congress doesn't get power over everything.
Mm-hmm. I believe you were involved in that case.
I was involved in the leading federalism case in 1997, which invalidated the Religious Freedom Restoration Act.
Now, federalism, does that mean the same as states' rights?
Yes, federalism is the same thing as states' rights.
Now, traditionally, as we've said, the Democrats have been the party of the federal government and the Republicans of smaller government and more authority at the state level.
Well, what's so interesting is that the Republicans gained the power that they have now through the latter part of the 20th century and into the 21st by arguing for smaller government. But once they achieved large government and our control and control of large government, now we see the Department of Justice aggressively pursuing social policies at the expense of states' rights.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of irony in where different people are standing on it, on this issue right now. With respect to liberals, the original response to federalism starting in 1995 was vigorous, to put it in an understated way. And the theory was is that federalism and states' rights were just a code word for anti-civil rights. What's so interesting about the case that the court heard yesterday is we have a liberal agenda in California, and they're arguing for states' rights for a liberal agenda, and it's the federal government run by conservatives that's arguing for expansive federal power. So the way to understand federalism and whose position is where is simply to follow the power.
If you'd like to join our conversation, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at NPR.org. We're speaking right now with Marcy Hamilton, a constitutional law professor in New York and currently a visiting scholar at Princeton's Theological Seminary. Let's take a call from Nora, who's on the line with us from New York City.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Hi. I've been thinking that, you know, since the election, I really don't feel like people like me, you know, liberals, et cetera, are welcome in this country. I mean, really, I have felt for a while it took like 3,000 deaths so that for New York to become recognized as Americans, and it didn't last very long. And so now with the election, I mean, if we can't, like, get with Canada or get the European Union over here to help us out, I think at least, you know, we should try this new way, or, you know, old way in a new form.
The phrase, though, doesn't gag in your throat?
Well, no, it does feel a little bit like strange bedfellows, I have to say, but, you know, we have to do whatever we can.
Marcy Hamilton, and Nora is not alone.
Well, not at all. But what's so interesting about these times is that the Constitution is the liberals' friend now as much as it has been the conservatives' friend in the past, and it's federalism and states' rights that's going to permit the liberal agenda to be sought in the states in which they put the effort in. And so it's not that the country has become overwhelmingly one political viewpoint, but the Constitution splits up the country so no one political viewpoint can own every jurisdiction.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Well, Nora, thanks for the phone call.
Sure.
I guess there's a downside to that. If you're adopting a strategy of states' rights, as Democrats or liberals might call it, aren't you abandoning large parts of the country?
Pardon me, abandoning
large parts of the country, the so-called red states.
Well, if you are pursuing particular issues in a state legislature, state legislatures are historically easy to work through in the sense that there's not a lot of attention paid to what's going on there. And you can get many agendas through liberal or conservative through a state legislature that you could never get through Congress. It's much smaller. It's much more local, and so local people have more influence. So you are not giving up on every state. It's an issue-by-issue thing, and you have to go from state to state to make the argument. Now, the argument against federalism in the past was that it was so inefficient to go to all 50 states. But the answer to that has to be, well, that's the system we've got.
But if, for example, you're concerned about the issue of gay marriage, just as you would argue states' rights gives Massachusetts every right to keep gay marriage, you'd have to accept that the 11 states that just passed constitutional amendments barring gay marriage, that's okay for them, too.
Right. No, you have to take the bad with the good. There will be states who don't follow your policy predilections, and there'll be other states that do. But a good example of how these issues have developed is divorce. Divorce was highly... it was looked down upon for a very long time, and it took an experiment in various states, starting with Nevada, with no-fault divorce. As other states watched and saw that that was a better system than the one they had, no-fault divorce grew geometrically across the country. It's the same principle here. If we see that medical marijuana works in California, we don't have a lot of abuses and people are feeling better because they've been very, very ill, then we're going to see it expand. If it's a total disaster and there are too many doctors prescribing it for the wrong reasons, we're going to see that, well, that was an experiment that didn't work. We'll have to shut it down. That's the beauty of the system.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Bruce, who's with us from Portland, Oregon.
Hi, Neil. I have a question for Professor Hamilton, and that is recently the Supreme Court refused to consider the gay marriage ban or the approval of it in Massachusetts. And you just mentioned about the 11 states that during the last election basically banned gay marriage. And my question is this. Did the Supreme Court do this as a political maneuver to basically throw it to the states so that they only need 27 more to basically ratify the Constitution to amend it?
No. What the Supreme Court did there is actually extremely apolitical. The court never takes an issue the first time it comes up. And that was the first time the court had been faced with that particular issue. It's going to wait to watch how the issue percolates through the various courts in the country. When we get to a point where various courts have different viewpoints on an issue, and the issue is a federal issue, not just a state constitutional issue, that's when the Supreme Court will weigh in. But at this point, that was a state constitutional issue. There's no split among the states. It just wasn't time for them to weigh in yet.
I wonder if the case had been brought by a Massachusetts married gay couple who sought to have that marriage recognized in Ohio, just to pick a state out of a hat, that might have been an issue for the Supreme Court.
Well, that would have implicated a federal law that was passed a year ago that is the Defense of Marriage Act, which raises that very issue. If you've got a federal law at stake, then, in fact, the Department of Justice probably would ask for review, because they would like to get it over with. What's the answer to this federal issue? So that would be a completely different issue.
Bruce, thanks for the phone call.
Thank you.
And I guess, Professor Hamilton, the issue down the road is if the Supreme Court reverses itself on Roe v. Wade, the issue will be abortion.
Well, if the Supreme Court reverses itself on Roe v. Wade, we're going to see 50 states renewing their debate over abortion. Now, what's really happened with Roe v. Wade is that we have a vast diversity among the states in how they deal with abortion. I'm not sure the reversal of Roe v. Wade will change that very much.
But you will have had a situation where liberals in years past sought a federal solution to the issue of abortion, while the conservatives wanted to fight it out on state levels.
Yep.
Whereas now I think you probably see Republicans wanting to fight it out in Congress or with a federal law or a constitutional amendment, if that's what they think is necessary.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And one of the more humorous moments in recent history is when the Bush administration started to consider whether or not to have a federal marriage amendment. If there's anything that belongs under state control, it's marriage. And so when the Republican-controlled government switches over to creating a federal solution to something that's always been a local or state issue, you know that states' rights has now left their particular platform.
And briefly, before we let you go, by adopting some issues as states' rights issues, mightn't liberals pick up some conservative jurists who believe in states' rights?
Oh, I think that's very much possible. I think that is possible. Myself, I tend to be more moderate conservative, but on states' rights, when I see California wanting to do what it's trying to do with medical marijuana, I say, go for it. It's a good thing.
Marcy Hamilton, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Marcy Hamilton is the Paul Verkeil Chair in Public Law at the Benjamin N. Cardozo School of Law in New York and currently a visiting scholar at Princeton's Theological Seminary. She joined us by phone from outside Philadelphia. We're talking about who waves the banner of states' rights these days and why. When we come back from a break, we'll also take more of your calls. 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. You can also send us email. The address is totn@npr.org. We'll be talking about why states' rights might cause some Democrats to reconsider their position on tax cuts. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about states' rights as a political tool for both parties. And joining us now is Jim Holt, a frequent contributor to the New York Times and New Yorker magazines. And it's good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
And you recently wrote an article for the New York Times Magazine suggesting that blue or Democratic states may want to resurrect the doctrine of states' rights, and particularly on the issue of taxes.
Right. I was, you know, shortly after the election, and all my friends were kind of sulky and whiny, saying, oh, we should secede, or we have to move to Canada, and so forth. And I was thinking of ways to cheer them up. And I thought, well, they could read the works of the Stoic philosophers, but that's maybe not the most constructive thing. And then I thought, wait a minute, there might be a silver lining in this. Bush, in a way, might be our friend. And the reasoning is this. If you live in one of the blue states that voted for Kerry, you're probably living in one of the more prosperous regions of the country. The liberal enclaves are, you know, on the coasts, in cities like New York and Boston, and the West Coast and the Great Lakes states, and that part of the country bears a greater part of the federal tax burden than the red states that voted for Bush. Now, Bush, of course, has already lowered our taxes twice in 2001 and 2003, I believe. And when he did that, he made things easier on the blue states because, in fact, the blue states send more money to Washington than they get back, and the red states get back more than they send. So the blue states, where the liberals by and large live, are actually subsidizing the red states. And I remember this, you know, came vividly to mind years ago when Newt Gingrich was railing against the federal government, and someone pointed out that, you know, hey, Newt Gingrich's congressional district gets much more from Washington than they send in. So actually, his district is sort of a welfare case dependent on the federal government. So anyway, I thought what Bush has already done and is offering to do more of to make permanent are tax cuts that reduce the subsidy that the blue states pay to the red states, and that means that more of this money stays in the blue states, and they can spend it on, you know, the sorts of values that they cherish that may not be cherished in the red states. Now, every year my federal taxes keep going down, and my local and state taxes keep going up, so my tax burden, you know, stays about the same, and I'm happy with that. And, you know, there's more money is spent locally. You know, of course, in New York City, we have our own mini welfare state. Anyway, that's the rationale.
But, in other words, liberals would have reason to anything that would shrink the federal government would be good.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not making this case entirely seriously. I mean, there's a little bit of irony running through it. But I think that there are always unintended consequences, and in this case, the unintended consequences of Bush's tax cuts, one of them at least, is to reduce the burden on the blue states, to leave them with more money that they can spend in ways that they want. They can spend it to improve health insurance within their states, as Vermont has discussed doing, or they can spend it on education. Of course, the blue states already spend more per pupil on education in the red states, and, you know, maybe that's one of their values. And I also think that, you know, it's, you know, let a hundred flowers bloom. The red states should be free to, you know, pursue their own experiments. If you know, as I pointed out, if you look at the institution of marriage, it seems to be under greater threat in the Bible Belt states. They have a much higher divorce rate than the country as a whole. And if you look at Massachusetts, lo and behold, it has the lowest divorce rate in the country. So the institution of marriage seems more imperiled in the Bible Belt states than it does in Massachusetts. So maybe Massachusetts feels a little freer to do some progressive experimentation and to allow gay marriage. And the Bible Belt states, they would say, whoa, we better protect the institution of marriage, so let's ban gay marriage. I don't know if it'll work, but maybe it's worth a shot for them.
Let's get another listener in on the conversation. And Max is calling from Concord, California.
Well, you summed up a lot of what I wanted to say. I mean, this is something I had likewise thought of after it, to cheer up my mother, who was ready to shoot herself after the election. And I think it should be, to push it even further, by putting the money back into the hands of the states, people can decide, as opposed to move to Canada or Costa Rica or wherever else they want to flee to, they can actually just avoid the sort of politics that they don't believe in by moving to California or Utah. And I think that if the Democrats really want to push an agenda that's going to be popular, massive tax cuts at the federal level, putting the federal government, you know, back to being in charge of defense and a few other issues, put the money back in the hands of New Yorkers and Californians. And then when people in, you know, Wyoming to figure out they can't pay for their own state, they'll start raising taxes. It'll be, you know, a nice surprise for them. So I think this is an excellent idea, should be taken seriously and pushed hard.
Jim Holt, I guess there's an aspect of what Max is talking about which might lead to even greater polarization.
Oh, you mean the liberals in red states moving to blue states and
vice versa?
Yes, yes. Well, actually, funny thing is that, you know, in many ways, blue states are more similar to European countries than red states are. And one respect in which they're more similar is blue states have a lower fertility rate. The population is increasing faster in red states than in blue states. So blue states actually need a little bit of immigration from red states. And if so, some of the more left-leaning people decided to move from red states to blue states, that might help things. Mm-hmm. But I don't seriously advocate lots of internal migration. I think that, you know, that politics is a cyclical thing. As Arthur Schlesinger pointed out, you have right-wing and left-wing cycles that run that turn about every 20 years. And so I think that, you know, also presidential administrations tend to self-destruct to some extent in their second term. So I think people should stay put, you know, for the time being. But there is reason for a little bit of rejoicing among liberals in the blue states.
Max, thanks very much for the call. Let's talk now with Steve. Steve is with us from Ogden, Utah.
Hello.
Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Yes, I want to weigh in as a conservative, as someone who still advocates the principle of states' rights, which to me, more than anything, is a matter of adhering to the principles of the Constitution restricting the powers of the national government, which I think remain a very important principle. I also think that the idea of the state functioning as laboratories to experiment with different approaches to addressing our problems is a very worthwhile feature of what generally comes under the rubric of states' rights.
I'm sorry, come again on that last thought, Steve?
Well, I was just saying that the concept of the states taking different approaches rather than having a uniform national approach to various issues enables them to function as laboratories to determine what works better and what doesn't work. And frankly, my belief is that conservative approaches do work better to address our social problems than liberal approaches.
But if there was an issue on which you did not necessarily agree on the issue, but if it was a states' rights issue, you would say, go ahead.
Well, up to a point. I mean, there was mention earlier of what happened in Massachusetts on the issue of same-sex marriage, and I think something like that is an abuse of the judicial function, and
if it was
intervention with something like what's been proposed at the national level.
Yeah, but if it was approved in a referendum or by the state legislature?
That would be a different matter.
So, Jim Holt, there are people like Steve who hold to the idea of states' rights as a matter of principle. Am I right, Steve?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's good, and I like his point about the states functioning as laboratories, and you get more empirical evidence on how good certain policies work. But I would disagree with him when he says that, I would quibble perhaps with his belief that the conservative policies always work best. I think an interesting case is criminal law and the severity of the punishments for different crimes and the use of the death penalty. This varies widely from state to state. I used to live in the state of Maine, and I was quite proud when I would go to Europe, and Europeans would say, "Oh, you Americans are so barbarous! You have the death penalty." And I said, "Look, I'm from Maine. We abolished the death penalty in 1887, long before the French did." I was quite proud of that. That's a rather silly point, but the interesting point is, if you look at the states that have reinstituted the death penalty since the Supreme Court said that was okay back in 1976. They have, as a whole, a higher murder rate than the states that don't have it. Now, you can say that, you know, correlation doesn't imply causation. Okay. But if you look at states in the 1980s that put in place very severe mandatory sentences for crimes, strictly for drug crimes, and you compare them to the states that did not take that more punitive approach, the drop in crime is the same on in each case. So what that seems to mean is this experiment shows that that simply piling everyone into lockup and executing prisoners for capital crimes doesn't do any good in deterring criminals. It doesn't bring down the crime rate. So this is one thing we can learn from Federalist experiments, and I think that's a good thing. I'm all in favor of empirical evidence, and if the evidence is, you know, shows that a conservative policy works better, I'll buy it.
And Steve, we'll accept the idea that you may have drawn a different conclusion from the same pieces of evidence, but and leave it there. And thank you for your phone call.
Thank you.
Let's get to another caller, and this is Colin, who's with us from Oklahoma City.
Hi there.
Hi there.
Very interesting show today.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say that I'm a liberal. I'm extremely liberal, and I live in one of the reddest states in the country. And my thought is that, well, states' rights probably seems very appealing if you live around liberals and you live in places with very progressive policies. It would be an absolute disaster in parts of the country where they're, you know, where politicians are not necessarily naturally inclined to be so enlightened. Like, if you're an African-American living in the South, you might not be so crazy about the concept of states' rights. And I don't know, as someone who's, like, trying to fight the good fight out here, I feel kind of offended when I hear, you know, all this talk of secession and it just, and, you know, states' rights and pulling back from the rest of the country because, you know, I'm working hard out here, you know?
Well, Jim Holt, this Colin raises the exact point. I mean, doesn't embrace of states' rights in New York leave people like Colin out in the cold?
Well, yeah, that's a good point. But, you know, the truth is, what else can we do at this point? I mean, the Democrats don't have really any power in Washington for the time being. They can't, you know, about the best they can do in the Senate is filibuster. And so a lot of senators from states, like New Jersey, Senator John Corzine, for example, is talking about or is considering apparently running for governor and leaving the Senate because there's just not that much to do in the Senate at the moment. I don't think that if there's an increased emphasis on trying to, you know, pursue a more liberal vision of a just state within the states where liberals have some power, I don't really see how that hurts states like Oklahoma. If the liberal experiments are successful, Oklahoma will be able to observe that and perhaps put, you know, the best parts of those policies in place in those states. So I don't, you know, it doesn't seem to be a zero-sum game exactly, and I really do think that there's really not that much else that liberals can do at the moment.
Well, can I just come in and make a proposal of my own?
Sure.
What I think we need nationally is more of a return to a sort of populist ethic where we find ways to work as, you know, as a party, and this is me speaking as a Democrat, working as a party to talk to people who don't, you know, don't have as much as other people, the disadvantaged and, you know, the people who are trying to, you know, just make a living. And in Oklahoma, FDR is practically a saint. And the National Party seems to have just sort of turned away from all of these voters out here who would vote Democratic if people were talking to them. And it just, I feel like turning inward more towards the coast is not going to help Democrats win elections in the future. And that's, I guess that's all I have to say.
Okay, Colin. Thanks very much. Appreciate it.
You think of the great Oklahoma populist Fred Harris, who I think the last great populist figure that I can think of from the middle of the country. I believe he gave the nominating speech for George McGovern back in 1972.
I believe you're right.
As a matter of fact, his wife, LaDonna Harris, who was a full-blooded American Indian, as I recall, ran for vice president in 1980 on the Citizens Party ticket with Barry Commoner. And that year, I actually voted for Barry Commoner, LaDonna Harris, throwing away my vote. But I've learned since then not to do that.
Jim Holt, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Jim Holt is a frequent contributor to the New York Times and New Yorker magazines. He joined us on the line from his home in New York. We're talking about states' rights reconsidered. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And joining us now to continue this discussion is Michelle Goldberg, a contributing writer to Salon.com, also working on a book about culture wars in America. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, you've also written about the states' rights issue and said liberals who threatened to secede after the election were indulging in escapist fantasy. Why should they embrace states' rights instead?
Well, I think that, as some of the other speakers have said, because they don't really have very much of a choice. I'm not sure that states' rights is necessarily a principled position for liberals any more than it's been a principled position for anyone. I think, as you know, some of the other people have said, it's a question of power, and liberals have no power. They have essentially no say in how their country is being run right now. If they want to do anything in the next 4 years except kind of play defense and watch as the New Deal and the Great Society are kind of dismantled, they're going to have to do it on the state levels.
Just as a practical matter, and whether you're a believer in states' rights or not, look at it issue by issue.
Although at the same time, I would say that I think that there has been a kind of psychological shift among many liberals due to the kind of profound alienation that so many feel from the rest of the country. There's always been this sense among progressives that they have to, a kind of admirable sense, I think, that it's up to them to save the entire nation, to look out for the poor and oppressed in states where the majority might want to tyrannize them. I mean, you know, I think all of us are glad that Martin Luther King didn't embrace states' rights and that, you know, and that the Freedom Riders, you know, weren't willing to kind of let the South do their own thing. But right now, there's such a feeling that these states have almost declared war on our values, and by that I mean blue state values, and actually act as if blue states don't have any values at all, but are just these kind of sinister, decadent cosmopolitans. That if we want to kind of preserve anything of what we love about this country, we can only do it around our own homes.
Well, hang in there and stay with us. So we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to finish this conversation about states' rights and then take a sneak peek at rumors swirling around tonight's show, Jeopardy. If you'd like to join the conversation on either subject, our phone number is the same, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, and here are some of the headlines that NPR is following this afternoon. The first person ever to hold the post of Homeland Security Secretary is leaving office. Tom Ridge informed the White House and his staff that he's stepping down, and supporters of Ukraine's opposition leader have broken off talks with the government over last week's disputed presidential election. They accused the declared winner, Ukraine's prime minister, of dragging things out. Details on those stories coming up later today on All Things Considered from NPR News. Tomorrow on Talk of the Nation, we'll take a look at how the military fulfills its quotas for new recruits amid rising casualties in a controversial war. That's tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. Today, we are talking about states' rights. Our guest right now is Michelle Goldberg, a contributing writer to Salon.com. And let's get another caller up on the line. This is Michael, who was with us from Salt Lake City.
Hello.
Hi, Michael.
I find it very interesting that as the nation turns toward a more conservative view, that liberals want to leave, want to secede. I remember not too long ago that when the nation was taking a more liberal position, the conservatives weren't screaming and saying that they were going to move, to leave the country. They worked quietly within the system to change things towards their point of view.
Michelle?
Well, I think that we all know that at one point the conservatives did indeed try to secede, and that kind of secessionist mythology has been very much alive. I mean, you're still having battles over the Confederate flag. I think that, first of all, I don't think that the secession talk is necessarily serious, and I should also say that liberals don't want to leave their states. They want to retain their states. I think that many of them feel that the country is becoming a place that they don't recognize. It's not veering slightly more to the right or slightly more to the left, in that it's becoming a fundamentally different kind of America than has ever been before. Then it kind of is increasingly, going away from any of the values that they ever thought to associate with our country. But actually, I think that in certain ways, states' rights are a way to do exactly what the conservatives did do after Barry Goldwater's defeat, when they really started organizing at the local level and took over the school boards and took over the town councils and kind of worked from the bottom up, so that now they have a huge base in huge parts of the country. I think liberals need to do much the same thing.
Michael, do you find it similarly ironic when you see conservatives now in power in Washington saying... state rights, state schmites.
Well, I actually support states' rights, strangely enough, as a conservative. I believe that there needs to be a balance. I believe that we ride the balance between the liberals and the conservatives, between federal power and states' rights. And that's how we find the middle of the road. And I think that's what makes democracy work, is that we have those two opposing views.
Okay, Michael, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
And let's see if we get one more call in on this subject. David is with us from College Park, Maryland.
Hi, yes. Thanks for the interesting show.
Uh-huh.
I'm calling because I am concerned that there's been too much of an advocacy for Democrats to retreat into kind of a posture of just focusing on their states. It's hugely important that Democrats continue to try to also change things at the federal level, because that affects so many people's lives. For instance, Jim Holt was talking about the issue of taxation, and I think it's hugely important that Democrats continue to work to get a more progressive federal income tax and to use those resources on education and health care, and that this talk of states' rights is okay. I mean, there are some interesting points, for instance, on the issue of gay marriage, but we shouldn't just focus on the states. We should continue to try to change also at the federal level, because it affects so many people's well-being.
Michelle, this is the fundamental conundrum, isn't it?
It is, and I really sympathize with what the caller is saying, although I think we have to accept that at least for the next 2 years, we can do nothing. We can, at the most, kind of use the filibuster strategically to head off some of the most kind of egregious initiatives of the right, but a more progressive income tax, or kind of more, kind of economic, policies that are more economically just, as much as I would like to think that there was a forum for progressives to work towards that at the national level, we are wholly unrepresented in any of the centers of power. And so I think that the question isn't, do you kind of give up on economic justice nationally forever, as much as you can only kind of bash your head against a brick wall so much, I think, before you're really going to turn people off politics entirely. If you want to give these activists who were so kind of amazingly energized by the 2004 election, if you want to keep them in politics, you have to give them, I think, something to work for that they could actually achieve. You have to give people some avenue in which to improve their own lives, and we can only do that right now at the state.
David?
Well, I see Ms. Goldberg's point, but I think it's important, though, even if, let's say, the Democrats can't make over the next, say, 2 to 4 years, the kinds of changes that we would like to see, we should still try, I mean, in the sense of get our points out there, stand up for them, and give reasons for why our ideas are better, even if it doesn't result in concrete policy changes over the next 4 years. At least it might help us avoid things moving in a much less progressive direction, and maybe it also will help us build momentum for the future and turn more people into being Democrats. You know, it's like you get out there, you, like Howard Dean did. You make your point. You get your message out there, like Barry Goldwater and Ronald Reagan did also. And maybe over the next 2 to 4 years, you're not able to get your policies. To actually get implemented, but maybe that can build a foundation for the future.
David, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
And we're going to give you the last word. Appreciate it. Michelle Goldberg, thanks very much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you very much.
Michelle Goldberg is a contributing writer to Salon.com, and she joined us by phone from her office in Brooklyn, New York.